Hello and welcome to this week's A Photographic Life and the continuation of the conversation between myself and Bill Shapiro. Bill's has served as the editor-in-chief of Life, the legendary photo magazine, and also was part of the relaunch in 2004. Later, he was the founding editor-in-chief of Life.com, which won the 2011 National Magazine Award for Digital Photography. He is also the author of several books, a fine art photography curator for New York galleries and a consultant to photographers, a contributing editor to the Leica Conversation series, and he's written about photography for the New York Times Magazine, Vanity Fair, The Atlantic, Vogue and Esquire, among others. I'm Grant Scott, and my whole career has been connected in some way with the printing of photography and editorial photography, as a creative director, as a photographer, as an art director, as a curator, and as an editor of magazines. Now, why is all of this background important? Well, I think it's important particularly for this week's part of the conversation, because we're going to talk about editorial photography and the thought that we both have that it's dying. Well, Bill, welcome back to the conversation. Great to see you. Great to talk to you again.
I'm looking forward to today's episode, Grant, because it's a subject that you and I both know so much about.
Well, finally, we have come across a subject that we know something about.
Yes, it's about time.
And as such, I will shock all regular listeners by admitting the fact that you haven't spoken to anybody in your usual way. We're just going to go freeform with this.
Yeah, because partly I felt like, you know, given the topic, which you'll introduce in a second, I think we've both lived through this so many times. I know I have, that I got plenty to say.
I think we have. And I'm going to let everybody know this is going to run over two episodes at least, because both Bill and I feel that this is so important. Now, we do come from the world of publishing, so let's kind of fess up to that at the beginning. However, what we're going to talk about is, I think, the slow death of editorial photography, the slow death of publishing as a platform, as a showcase for that photography. And I think through that conversation, we're going to talk about where it was, where it is today, where we think it's going. But I suppose in a way, you know, Bill, you're always great at suggesting where the conversation should go. And this time I kind of took the reins, primarily because I have got this book coming out in April, which is dealing with six decades of magazines coming out of Vogue House in London. That's GQ, Vogue, Tatler, World of Interiors, House and Garden. So it covers all of the areas of editorial photography. And in writing that book, it really made me think a lot about the context as to where we are with photography and with publishing.
Let me interrupt for one second for your listeners over here in the States. What is Vogue House?
So Vogue House is what it says. It's a building, and it was a building which Vogue magazine moved into. So basically, Cy Newhouse, the Newhouse family, as it then became, of course, he bought Condé Nast in 1958. And in doing so, he moved all of the English magazines. At that time, it was only House and Garden, Vogue, and Brides. And he moved those into this building, which had just been built in Hanover Square, which is in the middle of the West End of London, squeezed between Regent Street and Oxford Street and Piccadilly. As I said, they were the first people to move in. Strangely enough, the building was owned by the Church of England, but they moved in and they put some big gilt letters on the front of the building, carved in Vogue House. And they've been there since 1958 until a couple of weeks ago when they left.
So a couple of things. I worked for a couple of Condé Nast magazines in the 90s at 350 Madison Avenue in New York, where all of the Condé Nast magazines were, with the exception of the New Yorker and Details, and I think a couple of others that were nearby. And then when they moved out of 350 Madison and into the new Condé Nast building at Times Square, I worked there for Details as well. You know, the other thing I'll mention, as you talked about the letters being put, you know, the big letters being put on the building, was that it wasn't so long ago. I think it was a year or two ago, when after some of the purchases and repurchases of Time magazines, Time and Life magazines, when I saw them take the Time Inc. letters off the building, pry them off the building when it was purchased by Meredith. You know, no sooner had the deal gone through than I think like that evening, you know, the workers were up there ripping down TIME.
Well, you know, I think that in itself is a metaphor for where we are in publishing both of those stories. I mean, the thing with Vogue House was that the top floor of the building was photographic studios. And Irving Penn did his flower pictures. It's where David Bailey and Donovan and Duffy, the famous photograph of Mick Jagger with the fur hood around.
Yeah,
that was taken in Vogue House. Everybody was photographed in the studios. Helmut Newton worked there all of the time. So it has a fantastic photographic connection, but also, obviously, it was the home of magazine publishing in the UK for six decades.
Do you know how many people once worked in Vogue House?
They're all in the book. I can't remember the exact numbers, but you know, that was kind of my hook, really, was this book. And what I wanted to just do was, I suppose, kind of start at the end, which is the last kind of paragraph that I've written for the book, and that appears in the book, I think is a good place for us to start with the conversation. It says this: I will end by asking you three questions. How often did you buy a magazine in the past? When was the last time you bought a magazine? And when will you next buy a magazine? Your answers will dictate the future of the magazine publishing industry. It really is that simple. What do you think, Bill?
I think that is so on the nose. And as I listen to you read those questions, I mean, I have to look at myself before I look at anybody else. And the answers to your questions are not good.
And my answers would be exactly the same as yours. And yet, I'm sure that you and I, and a very large percentage of our listeners, the gateway to photography was through a magazine.
That is 100% true for me. And, you know, I used to, when I was working every day and making my way up the masthead at magazines, you know, I probably subscribed to 20 magazines. Literally, 20 magazines would come every month or every week. Plus, I would buy dozens more on the newsstand just to see like what else is out there. And it really did have that kid in the candy store feel for me, and the excitement, because I'd see an image on a cover that of a magazine I'd never heard of. And some of the magazine stands in New York, as I'm sure the same in London, you know, were 50 yards long, you know, and six shelves high. And you could really spend a lot of time looking for the thrilling images, buying the magazine and seeing new photographers, new writers, new ways of packaging material. And that's just not part of my experience anymore.
Well, you're right. And as a small child, and I mean small child, I'm like a 7-8 year old, on Sundays we would have the Sunday Times color supplement magazine at the breakfast table, and the newspapers would be handed around, and my brother, my father, and what have you, and we would look at them, and I would be exposed to the work of Don McCullen, or to Colin Jones or whoever else it may have been at the time, the fashion, the reportage, the still life and the food. And then, of course, when I started working in magazines in 1985, I was working with a lot of people who had worked on the magazines I'd looked at as a child. Mm. So there was this fantastic kind of creative baton passing as we progressed through the 80s, from the 70s and into the 90s. But I do know that that very much started to break down in the early 2000s. Now, not only do we have people now who are not buying the magazines, but obviously we also have photographers who are not able to see that as an income.
So let me, you know, I want to avoid the two, the sort of trope of two guys who are our age, looking back and talking about the good old days, which we could do for a long time. But I do want to ask you this, as someone who was likely like me, quite addicted to magazine looking and magazine buying and magazine exploring, why don't you do that anymore? And I'm thinking about the answer for myself as well.
I'm going to be really harsh about this. My wife only recently cancelled her subscription to Vogue. So we did always have that coming into the house. But basic, the journalism isn't good enough. The photography isn't good enough. The editorial direction of the magazines is safe and repetitive.
But I want to ask you this, because that is, I think what you're describing is sort of a death spiral, because as fewer people read the magazines, the budgets get smaller, the circulation size goes down, advertisers, we'll get into this, but one reason is, you know, advertisers need a big circulation. And so as the budgets get smaller, there are fewer photographs and fewer maybe good photographs, and maybe the editors aren't quite as talented, or more to the point, they're being asked to do too much. Because staffs have been slimmed down and they have to work on the iPad edition and they have to tweet and they have to post on Instagram and all the rest of it. And live events and custom content. And a staff can't do all that. And so the quality drops and then more readers drop, and then they have to lose more people on staff because the budgets have fallen. And it is a death spiral, what you're describing.
Yeah, it absolutely is. And I think that what's so sad about that, and I quite agree with you, I think it's very difficult for us to even begin this conversation without sounding like these two guys are saying, oh, it was so great then. I mean, interestingly, in writing the book, I thought that I would be writing about the 1960s as being the golden period. And actually, on reflection, what I realized was it was the 1990s, which was really the golden period of creative freedom being given to photographers, art directors taking risks, editors doing creative work. It may have been the drugs, it may have been the drink and the partying, I'm not sure. But certainly there was a real sense of adventure, which has closed down. I'm not sure I agree with you about the financial side of things. What roughly 10 years or so ago, I launched a magazine called Hungry Eye, which was a monthly magazine about photography and film. And it was only me and a laptop, and I wrote it, designed it, commissioned it, sold the advertising in it, and did everything for that. So I think that a lack of budget can produce creativity. I think the difficulty is that we're in a situation now whereby, as we know, people are gaining this information in other areas. So they don't necessarily need that magazine as the place that's giving it to you.
I wanna talk about this a little bit, because I think starting a magazine with a smaller, tiny staff and a smaller, tiny budget, I agree with you. A lot of creativity comes from that. And I've done that. I've done, you know, lots and lots of low budget, you know, blank slate startups. And they're thrilling, by the way. But I think it's different when you take a magazine, and I'll just choose one at random. I could choose 100, Condé Nast Traveler. When you go from a place where there are 50 editorial staffers and budgets of, $6,000 a page for photography and text, and you're asked to cut that in half, it doesn't feel like creativity as much anymore. There's a different spirit. There's a sense of something dying, and it's hard. It's hard to birth something thrilling when things are being nipped or cut. And so I think it's a little bit of a different, I mean, I would agree with you that it doesn't take a lot of money or people to do something very creative, but when that thing starts at A and drops to Z, then I think it's a different, because then you've got readers who are trained, you know, for one thing, and they're getting something else. And I think that's a problem.
I think, and that's such a good example to use with Traveler, you know, when it was launched by Harold Evans, one of the greatest editors of magazines and newspapers and an incredible journalist, and who launched that magazine with the idea that we will take no freebies. You know, we will not promote stuff. We will not take free holidays. And it was an amazing showcase for writing and
photography. Yeah, and its slogan was Truth in Travel.
Yeah, exactly. Which is
and pure, that's gone.
Pure
and
that's gone. Yeah, completely gone. So, but I think, you know, if you're listening to us talking as well, it may seem that from a photographer's perspective, what we're talking about here is irrelevant. But I do think it's so important for photographers to understand the business side, the industry side, what's actually happening, which is impacting on the work, because there is so much great work that you and I now see in photo books, in exhibitions, being seen as the great work that came from commissioned magazine photography. That was where it began.
So yes, that's where it began. And it is thrilling to see a lot of those commissioned works now appearing in books and on gallery walls and being considered art and collectible, where once they were disposable and purchased for $3 and, you know, and then you didn't look at it anymore. So I do love that. I think from a photographer's perspective, I don't want to talk about how it was, because I think that's so depressing for a lot of people. But do we talk about, you know, what photographers no longer have from that venue, from the commissioned photograph, full page spread venue, and maybe what they're doing now to try to compensate for that?
I think that's interesting, but I'm not sure. And, you know, maybe people can get in touch with us and tell us, because I'm not sure that people are compensating for it. I think that the issue when we are looking at photography outside from the printed magazine is that within the printed magazine, it worked within a context that we could take time over, we can return to, we can store, we can keep. I'm just moving house at the moment, and the worst thing is moving the magazines, you know, because there are so many.
And it's funny you say that, because one of my old great friends, whose name is Bernard Ohanian, and he for years worked at National Geographic, and we'll talk about National Geographic, but before that, he collected National Geographics. And he asked me to help him move one time when I was a younger man. And there were probably, you know, 60, a whole lifetime's worth of National Geographics. And after I helped him move, I swore that from then on, I would only help illiterate people move, because it was too hard on my back.
Yeah. Well, I have been in many stately homes and country houses across the UK with massive collections of National Geographics.
But so I think, you know, one answer is not the answer, is that people now have all these photographs on their phone. And whereas I used to spend my time with a magazine, just like you said, go back and forth, look at pictures, look at the first picture, look at the last picture, et cetera, look at a story as opposed to a photo, harder to do that on Instagram. And yet at the same time, I am seeing more photographs than I ever have, and I'm being exposed to more photographers than I ever have, albeit the images are smaller than a baseball card.
Well, you know, we've spoken about this before, haven't we? But, you know, that whole flicking thing. And there's certainly a more demographic nature now, because you're discovering photographers, whereas previously the art director or the creative director or the editor were making the decision over the work you got to see. And right. it was much more limited. However, it was within a context. And I always used to joke that you could always tell the art director because they read the magazine on its side, because you were always looking for the photo credit. You know, right. So I was reading it kind of on its side all the time. Whereas, of course, now quite often, and when I interview young photographers and talk to young photographers, one, they don't read full stop. Secondly, they don't read magazines, and they don't know the names of photographers. But they'll say, I saw this picture on Pinterest, or I saw this picture on Instagram, but it's existing out of context. And I think that ability to understand photography within context is massively important. And I see a lot of comments on social media, particularly on threads, which really demonstrate the problems that come about when people don't understand the context in which images are used.
I, in fact, had this experience, the one you're describing, yesterday. Because, as I mentioned before, Richard Sherem and I just published a piece in Texas Monthly, and the magazine gave it 14 pages, which is unheard of these days. And they let Richard's photographs run across full spreads. They gave him lots and lots of room. And it's so rare and it's so glorious to see. And I think we should mention the exceptions as well as the rule these days. But to your point, the pictures are in context. We understand that from reading the magazine article and seeing all of Richard's pictures, we understand that he spent a year with a homicide unit in Dallas. And it's not just one graphic photo of a pair of feet on the ground of a murder victim, that this is part of a larger journey that he took. And I think that's important.
I think it's massively important because, you know, again, I go back to that idea of the person commissioning and laying out the pictures. My job, I always used to say, was to bring text together with image and make a new thing which was stronger than the two things independently.
Yeah. And one thing that you're really missing on Instagram is any sense of packaging, any sense of how the photos relate to each other in terms of size or different rhythm you get from one story to the next. So there's definitely something missing today. And, you know, the other thing that I think is missing for photographers was not only as a showcase for them to show their work, but to also gain experience being commissioned, you know, working with a client, the art director, the photo editor, working for an audience, which they have to figure out what that audience wants. And then also, you know, actually delivering on the assignment, going to shoot the celebrity or the musician or the situation, whatever it may be. And that's gone a little bit today.
And you're so right. And I had a conversation with somebody yesterday, which was incredibly frustrating. An artist who did not seem able to connect the idea that something could be professional and creative, as if the moment it's professional attached to it, all creativity goes out the window and you're just like this kind of machine. Whereas you and I know, and you know, you were at Life magazine, for goodness sake.
Yeah.
You know, there is no separation between those two things.
Well, and proof of that is the fact that all these commissioned photographs, whether it was by Saul Leiter for Esquire in the 60s or Avedon for other magazines, all those are being sold as fine art now. So
yeah, well, let's talk about Robert Frank for Harper's Bazaar.
Yes.
You know, I mean, it's very easy to kind of take these icons now. I mean, I always thought, you know, let's not forget that William Eggleston shot for Rolling Stone.
Right. I mean, if you look at many of the photographers known and not known, you know, in the 90s and before, but I guess I think 60s and 70s are the kind of art that's being maybe the 80s that are being shown as fine art now. So much of that stuff, especially if it was of anybody famous or of some renown, all those portraits were shot for magazines. They weren't just shot as fine art projects. So the idea of the person that you were talking about drawing that distinction between commercial and creative is ridiculous.
Yeah, and yet it's a dominant. And I think that the death of editorial photography as we knew it is really impacting as more and more people are kind of saying, okay, I'm going to do the personal project, I'm going to self-publish. And we're for that. You know, we're for that. We're not against that. But at the same time, it can create a really fake understanding of where a lot of the work that people are looking at came from initially.
That's right. Yeah, I'm actually thinking as you're talking about some of the images in my house on my walls. And I have this great one of Steve McQueen shooting a gun in the Palm Springs desert that was made by John Dominus for Life when he spent 3 weeks hanging out with Steve McQueen on a photo shoot.
Yeah, exactly that. So I think one of the other things which I hear, and I think this is why perhaps this conversation needs to include our understanding of how we've got into this situation. What are the commercial realities faced by the people working on magazines? Is I do hear a lot of photographers complaining about what magazines are paying, complaining about editorial rates, complaining about copyright stealing, complaining about everything to do with magazines as if they're this kind of big brother that hates photography. Mm-hmm. And as a photographer who works for magazines, I hear it and I feel it. So, you know, I'm not on the outside of this. However, I do think there needs to be much more understanding amongst photographers or more empathy for the situation of the people on the other side of the commissioning.
You mean the staff at the magazines?
Yeah, exactly.
Well, I have so much sympathy for the staff, and I'm so glad you brought that up because, you know, I've been an editor in chief of a handful of different magazines, including Life magazine, and I would not want to be an editor in chief today. Back in the old days, when I was doing it. You know, you focused on the magazine, you know, you did have to meet with advertisers, once in a while, you did have to do a couple of events, but now it is everything. It is all those things I mentioned a few minutes ago, and it's extremely hard and they are understaffed and their budgets are smaller and their deadlines can be tighter. And, I feel for them and I don't know how they do it every single day, you know, because a photographer might come in and shoot two assignments for a magazine in 6 months, maybe if they're lucky, I don't know, depend, you know, but the photo editor is slogging it out every single day.
Well, you know, my wife is the editor of a magazine that's published in the UK and the US. Every single day, she does exactly what you're saying. She does oversee the photography because they no longer have art directors. She has no real training in photography. She's got really good taste. So that really helps. But you're absolutely right. She gives talks. She talks about the brand. She oversees the social media. She does the podcast. She talks to the advertisers. All of that stuff. And yeah, I know that she does get grief from photographers who act really as if they're the enemy. And I don't think they are. We never were when we were working on magazines. I don't think the people on the other side are the enemy. And I think photographers have got to understand the economic reality of a magazine.
Right, because nobody becomes a photo editor for a magazine because they hate photographers. You know, it's quite the opposite. And so I would hope that photographers understand that these are people who love photography, who want to make and spread beautiful images and big ideas, and yet they are hamstrung.
Yeah. I mean, a good friend of mine who's an art director of many, many magazines always refers to the men upstairs as the ones who kind of are actually putting the boot down.
So if we were going to take this this part of the conversation and make it more useful for photographers, you know, thinking about what tips or what advice we can give them to better interact with their photo editors, I think empathy is one. I think, you know, we talked about some of these things in a previous episode where we had some photo editors talking about mistakes that photographers make. And it might be worth going back and re-listening to that or listening to it if you haven't heard it. It was a couple months ago. But, you know, sending very large files in a pitch note is not a good idea. You know, and there was a lot of other ones, but I think making it as simple for your photo editor to make his or her decision to get in touch with you, all those things will help them and will help them help you.
Absolutely. I mean, my wife gets over 600 emails a day. She still talks about the photographer who sent her a tea bag and a packet of biscuits as a kind of introduction to their work, as a kind of, and she still remembers it because right. It was, yeah, that was really nice.
That's the most British thing ever. If somebody sent that to me, I don't know what I would think. But anyway.
Over here, you go straight to the top of the list. You exactly. Send a biscuit and a cup of tea. But I think that, yeah, you're right. It is about empathy. And there are a lot of things that we can talk about how you actually should be working with editorial people. I think, and this pains me to say, but I don't actually feel there's much of a future left for editorial photography outside of the small independent magazine, the small art magazine. But even then, the chances are you won't get paid. A lot of them ask you to pay, which I say to all listeners, don't go anywhere near it. You know, stop that behavior. But I know people do charge.
But let me ask. So I think you're totally right about the small independent magazines that are creative, that have a creative staff, that are hungry to do great things and have no money to pay. I have no stats to back this up, but I do feel like photo books are more, you know, they're just out there more than I remember in the past. Big and small, mostly small publishers putting out lots of photo books. I wonder if the photo book is sort of the new magazine when it comes to photographers exposing their work. It's not about the experience you get with a commission. It's not about maybe you know, being sent somewhere you'd never dreamed of going or had no experience and trying to figure it out, but it is the way that people are getting their work, or they believe they're getting their work seen in a longer format. What do you think of that?
I think your use of the phrase think that they're getting seen
yeah.
is the key. Because the problem is that what we're really talking about is silos and algorithms. And I could pick up a magazine and I would be introduced to a whole load of different photographers doing different work in different ways. Illustrating different features. You know, I might see some travel, I might see some still life, I might see some food, I'll see some portraiture, I might see some documentary, I'll probably see some fashion, I might see some beauty, depending what kind of magazine it was. I might see some cars or what have you. The problem now is that what you see is dictated by what you're already looking at, and therefore the algorithm is feeding you more of the same. And the idea of the photo book going out there is actually going to an audience who already like your work. So it becomes, I don't actually have an answer for this at all.
So what you're saying is really interesting to me. And I agree with you. And I haven't really thought about it like that. You know, often mostly every Friday, not religious. On my Instagram feed, I try to introduce my followers to a new photographer that maybe they haven't heard of, or an older photographer, an ability to sort of show their work in a new way or a new context. And people are responding really well to that. And I think you've just pointed to one of the reasons why, is because if I'm in your algorithm, you're getting my curation, but you might not be seeing that stuff otherwise because it's not coming to you because Meta or Facebook isn't sending it to you. You know, it's sending you something else. And I think that idea of trying to open up your algorithm in some way is a really interesting idea.
Boy, do you know, I don't know if you're aware of the French photographer, Robert Fresson.
I'm not.
Well, Fresson is someone who I recommend to you, Bill. Robert Fresson.
I accept.
He was a great photographer, and there are a number of books on French cookery and Italian cookery, and he would just go around and just take these very informal photographs of the food. And he's kind of one of the first photographers to break down that idea of very set up kind of photography. He was a brilliant photographer who did food rather than anything else. So it would be really interesting for you to put Fresson on your Instagram as an example and then see how people respond.
I love it.
To a food photographer within that. Because actually, you know, what I try and do on this podcast is we have documentary, we'll have analog, we'll have music photographers, I've had food photographers, celebrity photographers. So I'm always trying to keep it as kind of open a broader church as possible. And in a sense, I suppose, this is where we are now. For the last 15, 20 odd years, I've been proclaiming, and nobody's been listening, that podcasts, broadcast, is the new publishing. And that actually, this is where magazine publishing is losing out. Because people say, oh, the web and the online or whatever. I don't think so. I think that what people are getting from podcasts, what they used to get from magazines, conversation, discussion, drama.
Surprise.
Yeah. And you and I have discussed previously how sort of in the green room, how we're listening to podcasts and neither of us knew that we were listening to those podcasts, but they're completely separate away from photography and right. And whatever. So they also require that sense of commitment in subscription.
Now, of course, sadly, at least in this country, podcasts are undergoing the sort of economic stranglehold that magazines went through and continue to go through. And some of my favorite podcasts have been kicked off their platform or closed, or, you know, they're not getting the budget that they used to. And I think that will hopefully flatten a bit. It is, as advertisers, you know, what I saw in the magazine industry, and I haven't read a lot of intelligence about this, it's just my sense, is that advertisers want to go exactly where their potential buyers are looking. And if I'm looking at 10 ski photos on Instagram, I am going to get an advertisement for ski gear. That's harder to do with a general interest magazine. And I think, you know, the targeting of advertisers demographically and psychographically is something that print right now can't do as well as digital.
You're absolutely right. But again, someone was saying to me recently, all the adverts. I mean, we have to understand that as photographers, I think, need to understand this. A magazine exists on its ad revenue, not on its newsstand sales. Its newsstand sales are great, but its ad revenue, which is actually what makes it financially viable. With the net, the argument was, oh, everything's gone online, and so all that advertising has gone online. Well, it hasn't. But what has happened is that the online has given all of those brands an opportunity to go direct.
Right.
And that's the difference. It's not that all the advertising went online. And, you know, I hear publishers now talking about e-commerce is the way forward. And then I heard another phrase recently that someone said, all the pennies from e-commerce will never make up the pounds from ad revenue. And that's absolutely true. You know, so publishers are sort of frantically jumping on any bandwagon to try and come up with a way of earning money. But the reality is that those brands are going direct now. And so I think that a photographer should think about that. And instead of looking to the magazine, but they should be looking to the brand. And they should be looking directly to working with brands to create that kind of believable editorial content that brands now need.
Yeah, that makes sense. You know, speaking of newsstand and the death spiral of newsstand shrinking, National Geographic, for, you know, well over 100 years, I believe, on newsstands every month with that bright yellow border, has decided not to sell on newsstands and to only make a print magazine for their, I think it's 1.8 million subscribers. That seems to be a decision made in part by their owner, Disney, who also mandated huge staff cuts. And so there are no more staff photographers at National Geographic. And I believe there are no more staff writers at National Geographic. It's all going to be freelance. And with the exception of some special issues, unless you subscribe, you will not see it.
Which is strange, because that's going back to Reader's Digest as the, you know, the subscribers magazine of the previous decades. But what's interesting also, and in writing the book, what I identified was that a lot of publishers now are looking towards that subscriber model that we all have for Netflix, for Sky, for Paramount Plus, for sports channels. And in the States, of course, you have a very established idea. Magazines were always subscribed to in the States. In the UK, subscriptions were tiny. Everybody went newsstand because we didn't have the great distances to travel.
It made for a difference in the magazine covers. And because, you know, here in America, we didn't, you know, we would just send the magazine to people because they opted in once. You know, you in England had to get them to commit every single time because it was all newsstand.
Yeah. So we were sell as far as the covers. You couldn't have enough cover lines. But so this idea that, you know, in the States, you're used to subscribing to radio, to TV, to cable, whereas in the UK and across Europe, we've always had national channels. You know, we have the BBC for free. Well, we pay a one-off annual charge. But, you know, we've had all of these things. And I think that this model that's coming in now for magazines and publishing is an American TV model. And more people are seeing magazines as heritage brands, which they can then do other stuff with. But of course, without the photographers, without the writers, you don't have a brand.
You have a brand that day by day is fading. Because there's only so many years that you can rely on what was done in the 60s and 70s.
Yeah, exactly. So what you end up with is a logo.
Well, that's exactly right. And, you know, we've seen this with Life. It's a brand that I'm very close to and pay a lot of attention to. And what they do now, the way that you will see, I mean, there is some version of life.com, not the one that I created, but, you know, they do these bookazines. I don't know what you call them in England, but, you know, it's kind of like 75 years of Elvis, or, you know, 60 years since Marilyn Monroe did this, or, you know, the Beatles or Woodstock or commemorative issues, and playing on nostalgia, playing to an older audience. But, you know, I seen them on the newsstands now, and it's, you know, it's Dolly Parton, it's Betty White, it's these, you know, LITE light books, really, on a single topic matter, as opposed to the packaging and sort of synchronicity and curation and surprise of a magazine.
Yeah, I mean, my wife does bookazines all the time, and I'm always saying to her, "Who buys that stuff? It's just regurgitated." But they sell well. So
yeah, they do sell well, and they're a big profit source.
But from a photography perspective, it's just reusing archive and reusing material they already own.
That's right.
So the time has flown by, as I knew it would, when you and I discussed this subject. So before we move into the next episode next month, I think it's probably worth just kind of tying up a few loose ends, because I think we've gone off at lots of tangents.
Yeah.
But I think, are we in agreement that the loss of magazines for photography is a big deal?
I am 1,000% in agreement, and I wish we could come up with some creative substitutes for photographers. But I'm frankly a little bit at a loss. I can come up with some things that hit certain aspects of what a magazine did, but I can't come up with something that captures the whole package of what it used to do for a photographer, let alone a reader.
So I'm in the same camp as you. I think that, as you've quite rightly said, it would be very easy for us to be two old men just saying, "Oh, wasn't it good then?" And actually, yeah, in many ways, it was good. However, the idea of this conversation is not to kind of focus on the past, but is to look to the future. I don't think we have any answers, but I do think it's important that photographers have these conversations about this area of work, or where work once was, because I'm not seeing that conversation occurring anywhere.
You're not seeing the conversation between photographers, you mean?
Within the world of photography, actually addressing this, other than just saying, "Oh, editorial budgets are low, there's no work there anymore," and just kind of dismissing it. I think it's more nuanced than that. I think it's more sophisticated than that. And I think the impact on photography is much greater than just not having as many commissions as you once had.
I think it might be worth ticking off some of the things that photographers used to get from working with photo editors and being seen in magazines. And maybe that will lead listeners, photographers, to think about how they can get bits of these things in different places. So,
maybe that's a plan for the next episode. Maybe we're going to leave everybody on a cliff's edge waiting. It's like one of those soap operas, Bill.
Yes.
Dan, dan, dan.
To be continued.
Continued.
But, join us but I think if we can come up with some, if not solutions, some help and some direction in this next episode, I think people would like to hear that.
I'm sure they would. And I think I think it's a really good process for us to go through.
Yeah.
Because I think we've laid the groundworks now, I hope. We've thrown a lot of stuff around. And I hope if you're listening, you've enjoyed this. It's perhaps a slightly different episode than usual. But if it's made you think, get in touch with us. If you've got ideas, let us know through all the usual ways, through the United Nations of Photography.com website. Email me, get in touch with Bill, DM him through his Instagram. All the details are on the, wherever you're listening to this, on the page notes. And maybe you can help us come up with some kind of solution for the next episode.
I love it.
Great. Well, listen, Bill, I think this could be one more episode, or it could be the rest of the year. I have absolutely no idea. I probably do.
But we'll end up with glasses of wine, bottles of whiskey, and in the wee small hours of the morning going, and another thing.
Exactly. Exactly. My favorite kind of conversations.
Listen, Bill, thanks as always. And I really look forward to catching up with you again next month.
Thanks so much, Grant. Talk to you soon.
Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed this particular episode. And obviously, you can catch up with us again next week when we'll be back to the old school format. Don't forget to take care, will you?